continued to read from the memo, the Chinese side continued to push for an expansion of the American policy as enunciated last January. In our own consultations during the visit, the sentiment was clearly expressed for, quote, a next step, unquote, which would take us beyond implementation of the policy as now practiced. I am supportive of our policy of helping create a, quote, strong China. How we go about that is, of course, extremely important. I think it's clear that in a relative sense, China today is weaker militarily as against the Soviet Union than it was 10 or 20 years ago. In helping China become stronger in a military sense and better able to defend against attack, it is a nice calculation to determine what is a reasonable risk and what the Soviets could view as a deliberate confrontation to which they might feel obligated to react. We need to look at this developing policy in a wider context. The Japanese point of view needs to be determined and weighed. So does that of the South Koreans, who seem to welcome the new relationship between China and the U.S., who also seem to wonder when some Chinese moves may be made to temper the inflexibility of the North. Our ASEAN friends also have great interest in how we implement the forging of a, quote, strong China. Indonesia and Malaysia in particular have strong suspicions. This matter, too, is of grave concern in South Asia, including, of course, India. I may well be in favor of a next step, particularly one which some claim can be taken within the context of the existing guidelines. My objectivity, however, is clearly affected by my present position and situation. It would seem to me that the historic national, interest would be well served by some wider but discreet discussion the problems posed by the ongoing Sino-American military relationship. I suggest this not to oppose any further evolution, but to gain maximum support should further evolution seem wise and sensible. To raise this matter less than 6 weeks before an unpredictable election may seem impolitic, but unless some steps are taken now, the way may be clear after November 4 for the setting of fundamental policy by what Leon calls incremental steps, so that I wasn't worried about the evolution. I was concerned as to how it was to be done, and particularly concerned by the apparent lack of thinking as to the impact upon our close associates and allies, like in this case, Japan and the ASEAN countries.
And the politics of it in the United States.
Yes.
I think the Perry visit to me represented a flight into unrealism. I think the Pentagon began to have a bit between its teeth.
A part of the Pentagon.
Part, yeah. Well, but the JCS apparently was very much a part.
Yes,
too.
But not all the bureaucracy by any means.
Where was the
Well, I got the impression from discussions during that visit that there were still those in the lower levels of the military bureaucracy who were not reconciled to a China connection of any kind.
Uh-huh.
It was not by any means at the top levels. There was no problem. Not by any means a clear cut all the way through the ranks.
Leonard, I'm interested that you wrote the letter and wrote the letter in hand to the Secretary of State. Did you send it by cable, or did you then send this?
No, I was in the United States.
Oh, you were in the United States and hand-delivered this to him.
I gave it to Leon Billings for transmission to him.
Had you talked about this letter to others, such as to Dick? Did he know that you were sending this letter?
No. See, Leon Billings and I were close friends, and we'd had an extended discussion, and this was for use in making a preparation in the event the administration continued after the election. And I referred to the election in the memo as unpredictable. Unfortunately, I didn't really believe that. I thought it was only too predictable.
You thought it was already over by that time.
Right.
Okay, we're
interesting item that I overlooked on August 29th. The director of the State Bureau of Labor, Kang Yong-he, was going to the United States. The purpose of his going to the United States was because Ray Marshall, our Secretary of Labor, was looking for a reason to visit China, which he ultimately did after the election. And the closest we could find as a counterpart to him was the director of the State Bureau of Labor. So we gave a luncheon for him, and by this time, of course, the solidarity in Poland was, the events in Gdansk had already happened, and the movement was moving well along. At the luncheon, the conversation got onto the question of the status of women in society generally. In the course of the discussion, Sharon noted that a woman had been very prominent in the Gdansk events involving solidarity, and quite obviously women were of consequence in the Polish society. Well, I quickly changed the subject because I thought our guests would not want to discuss such things as trade unions, or not really a trade union, a labor movement having an independent existence in a communist nation. So I changed the subject, but he brought it back and went on to say that that he had been in Warsaw in the 1950s and had attended a congress of the trade union movement in Poland. He found it very deficient, not really representative of the Polish workers. And it was a good thing that the workers should have an organization of their own to express their own aspirations and their own interests. And he was very forthright in this, and I might say that when I was in Washington with the Bowie Bull Group, there was one occasion we were over at the Department of Commerce, and some of we were awaiting the arrival, I guess, of Vice Premier Bowie Bull. And the conversation got onto the events in Poland, and they expressed a similar point of view that this was very good. Now, I don't think this was entirely suggested by trouble in Poland meant trouble for the Soviet Union. That was part of it. Not all of it. There was a very genuine feeling that there's nothing wrong with this. But then as Solidarity got into a confrontation with the Polish Workers' Party, the Communist Party, then sentiment began to shift. But that was very interesting. Then I left, along with Sharon, to go to the United States. Went to the Chinese exhibition, which opened in San Francisco. And Vice Premier Bowie Bull came down from Canada for the purpose of being the Chinese representative in opening the exhibition. Secretary of Commerce Klitschnik did not come to the opening because there was a Jewish religious holiday, and his undersecretary, Hodges, Luther Hodges, came to represent him. It was very well done. I only saw it in San Francisco, and got tremendous press support and city support through Mayor Dianne Feinstein, who was very, very pro the China connection, and so it was quite successful. I was somewhat surprised by the lavishness with which the China Exhibit Corporation, of which Gil Robinson was the head, conducted itself. We had an inaugural dinner, which was very posh in the St. Francis Hotel. Now, that may have been self-financing, I'm not sure. In addition, on the day of the formal opening, we had a quite elaborate luncheon for the corporate supporters. And then the next day, a dinner for the bank supporters. And Vice Premier Boybo attended all of these sessions. And as I learned subsequently, they made money on the San Francisco part of it. Where they lost money was when they got to Chicago and New York, you know, being so much bigger cities and getting really lost in events. It was not a standout attraction as it was in San Francisco, so that totally, in a direct sense, they lost money.
They also, in New York, ran up against Bloomingdale having its own China week, wasn't
yes.
it? With which Bloomingdale was much more able to publicize its China week
right.
or month or whatever.
Right. And then we went to Washington for the Joint Economic Commission. Boybo was the Chinese chairman, and Treasury Secretary G. William Miller was the American chairman. There were meetings with the Special Trade Representative, Ambassador Askew, the Secretary of Commerce Klitznik, with the Exim Bank President John Moore, and I was very much impressed by the way Boybo handled himself in these meetings. Particularly the early morning meeting that we had with the Exim Bank, because of course the Chinese were pushing for concessional interest rates, which we're not able to do, except Moore kept trying to say that given an existing given a specific contract, things could be done to as offsets to the higher interest rate to, in effect, meet the competition. And I was impressed at how Boybo picked out the words that were beneficial to the Chinese side in the presentation that was made without any long speech. And in all of the meetings, I was very much impressed by him. He also had along with him the Minister of Finance, who is then fairly new. He's still the Minister of Finance.
Wang Bi-chun.
Right.
Wang Bi-chun.
But Minister of Finance, he's still the Minister of Finance, who handled the session when we went to, not the plenary sessions, which were also held in Treasury, but the session that we had in the Treasury on strictly bilateral matters involving the Ministry of Finance on the Chinese side, Treasury on the American side. And of course, the culmination of that visit was the signing ceremonies in the Rose Garden on the afternoon of Wednesday, September 17, when President Carter and the Vice Premier signed the Civil Air Agreement, the Maritime Agreement, the Consular Agreement, and the Textile Agreement, all of which had been concluded in time. And that night, the Chinese gave a big reception at their embassy to celebrate the event.
Who was the leading American at the banquet, do you remember?
This was a reception. No, I don't. I think it was Bill Miller. I don't think there was anyone those who'd been involved in the visit, which of course would be Miller and Klitznik and Askew, and John Moore of XM, all came, but I don't think there was anybody beyond that.
This president and the vice president, the president were out really campaigning. The president just came in largely for, or was he still holed up and non-campaigning? He'd already begun to campaign by this time, hadn't he?
I'm not sure. But talking about the campaign on in our final plenary session of the Joint Economic Commission on September 18th, the next day, September 19th, I went over to see my old friend Robert Strauss, who was, of course, in charge of the Democratic campaign. I have never seen Bob Strauss when he was so tired, so weary, and although he was insisting that the campaign was going to result in a final victory, he said he was so weary. He said, "When I'm out of this, I am never going to be involved in politics again."
It couldn't be a Bob Strauss if he weren't involved in politics.
Oh, that is very true. We then went to New York, and I made an appearance at the Council of Foreign Relations. I might say when we got to the question and answer period, as you know, there's two sessions, the one pre-dinner and then a smaller session that involves those at dinner and continuing after dinner. The very first question was on the what right I had to have my press conference of August 26th, if that didn't violate the unwritten rules of procedure for ambassadors. And I think the fact that it was not followed up would indicate that the answer I gave was, and it was a pretty large audience, the biggest one they'd had in quite some time because of the high level visibility at that time of the Chinese question, would indicate that they found my answer satisfactory. And then the next day, it was a big dinner at Bloomingdale's. Now this time the Chinese exhibition was still 2 or 3 weeks away, but it the 10th Street store was taken over in its entirety by Chinese exhibits. Very well done, of course.
What do you mean by the 10th Street store?
Bloomingdale's 10th Street store.
Oh, all the way downtown.
In New York, right. And then they took parts of it to their various suburban stores in the weeks following. And there was a big dinner given right in the store at which Boy Bo appeared, Chai Zemin. So that without any question, I think it diminished the effectiveness of the China exhibit, which was probably 6 weeks away at this point, but nevertheless. Then, while we were still in New York, we had our annual UN meeting with Wang Hua, with the new Secretary of State at Muskie. I think I've made reference to this. The chemistry was pretty good, and this was the first time that I remember it that the Chinese made a flat demand for the repeal of the Taiwan Relations Act in a formal meeting.
How did that come up, and were you taken by surprise?
Not taken by surprise, because there had been references to it back in meetings in Peking, but not in a formal sense. This was, after all, a formal meeting, and was raised. He was not very aggressive about it. It was more making the record, as it were, for future use. That was the atmosphere.
Did he encompass his request with complaints about how the Carter administration had been behaving?
No. The complaints about the TRA were the ones that they had put formally on the record,
right,
in the earlier times, and that this was inconsistent, was violative of the normalization agreement, and just had to be that problem had to be addressed for the normalization relationship to continue to move forward.
Had they already known about the extension of diplomatic immunities to the CCNAA officials, and was that mentioned in this meeting?
I don't think it was. It had been taken up before. Mm-hmm. They'd complained about that before.
And the sale of jet fighters come up, or military sales to Taiwan come up?
I think so. Not in the specific sense, but in the context of opposition to any arms sales, to continued arms sales being absolutely unacceptable and inappropriate to Taiwan.
Did you get a sense that this link to the request for TRA revisions were linked to the arms sales issue?
No, not necessarily. Not prompted by that.
The reason I press a little on this, obviously it relates to the question of whether the Carter administration had been reelected. Whether the Carter administration also would have encountered problems in dealing with China, perhaps not as acute as the Reagan administration has encountered, were the Chinese beginning to formulate a set of demands / requests which would have strain the relationship, and is this part of their strategy now, that they're going with every new administration to introduce some demands and keep pushing us on the Taiwan issue? I mean,
at the time, I didn't think so. Looking back, I would think the answer is probably yes.
Interesting.
Then, while we're still in New York, David Rockefeller gave a dinner for Boy Bull, and it was held at the Museum of Modern Art. Sharon and I found that pretty fortunate, because there was the viewing of the Picasso exhibit, which we otherwise would not have seen, since it was very difficult to get in. Of course, there weren't very many, so there was no crowd crush, and it was interesting to watch the Chinese reaction. Spent quite a bit of time before the Guernica painting, and had some comments to make about the Spanish Civil War and what happened there. And then at the
what did he say?
It was nothing exceptional, nothing that I particularly remember, except that he talked about it. He said about much of the abstractionist and cubist and so on. Well, these I don't understand. But then at the dinner, which was a very posh dinner, when he began his speech, he started it by saying, "As you know, I am a communist." And there was, you could hear a ripple go through the audience. It seemed to me that was self-evident, but it seemed to shock them that this should be said. Handled himself very well. Then we went back. We left from San Francisco and went back by way of Hong Kong because Tom Clawson, who was then still the chairman of the Bank of America, had invited me to attend their board meeting, which was being held in Hong Kong, and on the 6th and 7th of October. They permitted me to attend all the sessions, including the business sessions, which I found extraordinarily interesting because they went in detail into all of their operations in Asia, and also flew into Peking then from Hong Kong in the Bank of America corporate jet. I must say that that was quite a unique return to Peking.
What kind of plane is it?
It was a Grumman, as I remember it.
And then they have a Chinese come on board in Hong Kong for the flight up? Or?
No. No. When I flew in an earlier time with the Air Force plane, which carried the Sam Nunn delegation in January of 1979, they didn't have any Chinese aboard either. John Reinhardt had an ICA delegation that arrived just after we got back to Peking. And on their second day there, the 10th of October, double 10 day, assembled, we were going to meet a vice premier. And then, to our great surprise, at the very last minute, we were told we would be meeting vice chairman, Deng Xiaoping, who no longer, of course, was a vice premier. It was explained to us that the reason the vice chairman was receiving us, even though he was no longer a governmental official, was the importance of cultural relations. Then, as the meeting broke up, Deng Xiaoping said to Ji Jiaozhu, who was there, "I want to talk to the ambassador alone." And Reinhardt is telling his people, "Well, let's leave." And he said to them, No, it will only take a minute." There was also some American press who'd come in at the end of the meeting because Bill Sexton of Newsday took a picture, which I have at home. It shows the vice premier talking earnestly to me with his hand on my arm, and I'm looking very serious, and Ji Jiaozhu, just the three of us. What he wanted to talk about was there had just been announced the intention of the United States to sell ships to Taiwan. Now, as it turned out in the event, these were vessels of not much consequence that they had had on a lease basis for some time, and it was simply a badly handled routine thing, but it, you know, big story, sale of military ships, and there was something else involved. And I remember the vice chairman saying, "What's the matter with Carter? He's going to lose the election if he keeps this sort of thing up."
Is that what he said?
That's exactly what he said. Arthur Hummel, on his way back to Pakistan, spent 3 or 4 days with us at that time.
I don't want to pass without saying a little bit about John Reinhardt in this record, because he was really an outstanding head of ICA overall, but also in particularly for facilitating cultural exchanges with China. He really fixed the budget of ICA so that there was funding for the scholarly exchange program, for the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, for many of the